I haven't, as such, written a talk because it's about my life. So if I don't know my life, then I guess no one else would. I have made a kind of map of the dates, just because I might get confused. So that's the main preparation I did, apart from thinking about that, of course. Just by way of introduction. Well, yes, my name is Manjushvara. Within our movement, which used to be called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, when I first came along, it was called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, FWBO. And when I got ordained, I joined the Western Buddhist Order, but in the last few months, we've suddenly become the Triratna Buddhist Order, Triratna Buddhist Community, which is sort of a bit of a shock if you've been around for a while. But it's beginning to take its root in my consciousness. And I didn't fully, as it were, on a heart level, fully understand it, but in the last few weeks I've been teaching in Amsterdam, in Holland, in Ghent, in Belgium. And I suddenly realized one of the virtues of this new name is that it's now the Ghent Triratna Buddhist Center, the Amsterdam Triratna Buddhist Center. So these words have sort of become universalized. Triratna is an Indian word, three jaws. And so it's helped sort of universalize us beyond the limits of each language. So we're now Triratna. Okay, but when I came along in 1981, it was definitely the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. Oh yeah, what I was going to say was in our movement, our tradition, there is this tradition of giving what are called life stories. Some of us have done it, perhaps some of you haven't, but it's always been a feature, and it's a very interesting thing to do. Just to plot your life, look back and share with your audience, your friends, whoever, your life in this way. And there's lots of ways to do it. Some people do it every 10 years or whatever. So this is a kind of life story, but it's a Buddhist life story. Because clearly, what is clear to me, I wasn't born a Buddhist. I don't suppose many of us would have been, could have been. That's obviously going to start changing. But people my generation, at least, Buddhism has begun to take root, take flower during my lifetime in the UK. So I was born, perhaps like most of us, a Christian, nominally a Christian. And it was only as I came into my adulthood that I, as it were, took on Buddhism. So I've only got about 45 minutes, so it's going to be very brief, but I'm just going to give a kind of overview of my Buddhist life. This was prompted by the fact that up until June the 26th, because that's my birthday, up until June the 26th this year, I spent half my life in Triratna. I've now spent half my life and a few months in Triratna, so I've actually crossed that kind of significant marking post. I've now spent more of my life, gosh, I only just realized, I've now spent more of my life in this Buddhist movement than less. Is that the right one? Anyway, in other words, I'm getting on. But it's quite a thought. I haven't spent half my life in the order yet. That will take a few more years. But I'm moving towards it. And I never would have dreamed it. So that's the prompting for this talk. Srila Marlini kindly introduced me and said, I am a poet, and I'm a writer. I was originally a composer, I was a songwriter, became a composer. When I came into FWBO, it was then I was a composer. And that had taken me to the US of A, to California. And I was, in a way, I was trying to get into the movie business. I'd been down in LA. I'd actually been offered work at Francis Ford Coppola's studio, which is quite a thing, really, isn't it? I don't think they knew what they were offering, who they were offering it to and what they were offering, but anyway, it was an interesting thing. But I didn't really want to be in Los Angeles, so I was sort of travelling around on a quest, if I'm honest, which is another story which I may give another time. But, so we're now in 1981, I'm 28 years old, coming up. And, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to read you a poem. Just to set the scene. It's not one of my best poems by any means, but it's at least touches on an important subject. It's called Accident. Unanchored night in California, but the body knew to loosen its hold. It never meant to do harm, just a lesson. How the darkness can come for you, charging in, when there's nowhere else to go. Okay, so that's a poetic way of saying that in February the 7th, 1981, I was coming out of San Francisco with a couple of friends in a little Toyota car, and we were passing through, actually we'd been on the freeway, name I can never remember. Going towards Stanford University. Do you know that one? Going south from San Francisco. And we were running out of gas, but we pulled off the highway to try and find a gas station, as they call it. And basically, we were going through a green light, and someone else was going through a red light. And the other car going through the red light was a big American Chevy or something. It was much bigger than our little Toyota. And it won. And interesting thing, just by way of detail, I wasn't wearing a seatbelt, because back in that time in California, at least, I'm not sure about other parts, you didn't have to wear a seatbelt. And amazingly, it saved my life. If I'd have been wearing a seatbelt, I wouldn't be sitting here, almost guaranteed. Because I wasn't wearing a seatbelt, I was free, as the poem alludes, I was free to be catapulted out through the windscreen, which is not to be recommended, and then fly through the air and hit the concrete. That's what happened. The doctors later, when I was recuperating in hospital, said that, and it's a little secret, that the medical profession knows that maybe one time in 100 or more, seatbelts don't save your life, they probably kill you, because you get these kind of impact and you just take the full run. So Doc said, you were that 1% of situations where actually not wearing a seatbelt saved your life. He said, but I think you've used up that bit of luck, so if you want my suggestion, always wear a seatbelt. And I do. And I think it's good advice. But it's just a strange, one of those strange things about life, that just by not wearing a seatbelt, I was spared. I was injured, but I wasn't killed. Anyway, why am I telling you all this? Well, because I don't think you can have an event like that, or at least I couldn't have had an event like that in my life, that almost ended my life, come out the same person. And I didn't. I mean, it was quite a very strong experience, but not altogether unpleasant, strangely enough. I remember for the first few weeks, once I got out of hospital, I would be just sitting, you know, it was winter, but California winters are pretty nice. In fact, even more nice, because it's not so hot, but still sunny. And I was just sitting out in the backyard where I was, and just looking at the flowers, or the grass, the birds, and everything was miraculously beautiful. In fact, I do remember the first day when I was out of the hospital, I was just looking at the grass, and its greenness was so green that I just started weeping. I mean, I'm a poet, but I'm not that emotional usually. But it was just like everything was writ large. So it was a very, very powerful experience. And I think that caused me to really start considering what I was doing with my life and where I wanted it to go. Which I've been doing actually most of my life, because that's the kind of person I am. But for me, life had been an artistic life. Music, essentially. And that was very precious to me, but I kind of realized after this event that that wasn't going to be enough. take. This is a big subject which we can only touch on tonight. So the upshot of this was a few months later I was back in London to recuperate with the intention of going back to the States, which I loved. And I'd always wanted to live in America, and when I got there I didn't particularly want to leave, but I had to. So I came back to London, and by, again, a series of chances which I won't go into now, I found myself on June the 19th, 1981, going to London Buddhist Center. I know it was June the 19th, because the following week was my birthday. It was a Wednesday night. On Wednesday night at the London Buddhist Center, which is a center very like this, but somewhat bigger, in an old fire station, was where you could go to learn to meditate. And I'd seen the little advert, so I got to learn to meditate. And that's where I went. And I stood at the bus stop at the end of the Roman Road, where I was living, number 8 bus, and I remember thinking, if the bus doesn't come in 5 minutes, I'll just go home. And I was literally just about to turn around and go, because it was 5 minutes, and I thought, well, I have that. Because, in other words, I wasn't sure if I really wanted to go to London meditate. Someone, a friend of mine, a dear friend, had suggested it, although she was a Catholic. She said, you might want to try meditation. And I saw this ad for Buddhist meditation, so that was the connect. Anyway, I was just about to turn around and the bus turned up, so I got in. And I've often wondered, if that bus had been a moment later, would I have ever gone? Would I be sitting here tonight? So I got on the bus, and I remember getting off the bus and thinking, I still don't know if I really want to do this, but I could see the entrance of the Buddhist center. So I walked to the gate, and the bus, and it opened. And here I am. And as I touched on earlier, the meditation that we were taught was the Metta Bhavana. I remember walking into the lovely courtyard that they have there, like a little walled garden, and gave my money, and someone came up to me, a woman called Parami, that some of us know very well, a woman from Glasgow, a member of the order, and she just started to talk to me, and I explained that I'd just come back from New York, because I'd stopped off in New York after Saxon, and I was a composer. And she said, in an accent, which I'll do, but it's terrible, I'll turn the machine, hey, you and me, Dumarai! Or something like that. You and me, Dumarai! Anyway, basically, what she was saying was, you should meet someone called Dumarati. Dumarati is from Glasgow, but he's always wanted to go to New York. So that was the gist of it. So, indeed, I was introduced to this person called Dumarati, who was also from Glasgow. And, well, I can easily say he's one of my dearest friends. He taught me to meditate, but we became pretty much instantly, within weeks, very dear friends, and we've remained friends ever since. And I've travelled to India with him many times. And as I've said in his company, he's rescued me from wretched situations, holes that I've dug myself into, and sort of pulled me back out. So he's been a very precious, dear, true friend to me, a spiritual brother. So that, again, miraculously, the second person I met, Parami Dumarati, he's become one of the significant people in my life. So this was, feels to me I was in the right place at the right time, trying to do the right things, because it all started to fall into place. So indeed, Dumarati taught me, and then several number of us, 20 or so that evening, the Metta Bhavana. So what's the connection? Or what's the significance? Well, I touched on this in the introduction to the meditation, which was a good way to do it. Because why did I keep going back to the Buddhist center, to meditation? What did I discover in Buddhism that felt significant, rich, new, important? Well, in a way, I can sum it up as I did earlier. That Buddhism gave me an understanding, or at least a suggestion at that time, that one could change one's mental life, as it were, one of the mental states. And this is such a familiar idea to me now. I mean, I teach it myself in all sorts of ways. I have to kind of take a breath and remember that that wasn't always the view I had. And I touched on it in the introduction to meditation, as my dad used to say. My parents were Cockneys, so they get out of bed on the wrong side and that's it, isn't it? You know, they thought I'm miserable sort of for the rest of the day, as it were. And I think that's probably what I believe. That's what most of the people around me not only seem to believe, but acted. You know, some days you go up and you work, and other days you go up and you work. And it wasn't even that clear whether it was to do with the weather or whether you had a good breakfast. Like that, isn't it? Just that's the way it was. So one suffered that, as it were. One was trapped within this sense of this is the way it is. Or even bigger than that. You know, some people were born happy. People born sad. I always remember in this context, when I was a kid in the little town where I grew up, there was a man called Len Smith, who was the taxi driver. And one notable thing about Len Smith was he always drove big American cars. And I say, I loved America. I was always drawn to them. He had these big left-hand drive cars, huge things. And the thing about Len Smith was, whenever you saw him, he was smiling. He was laughing even. He would be in his car and you knew that when he came to view, you'd be... He was talking to someone or and he was always laughing, which was a fantastic, great thing. But my view was, well, he was just born lucky, you know. He likes his cars, I don't know. But, you know, not everyone is, some people were miserable. So that was the worldview I inherited and developed. So coming to the Buddhist center and being told, well, for 5 minutes, just try and feel good about yourself and then feel good about a friend, a stranger and so on. It was revolutionary, actually. And I know other people have said something similar. And it changed my life. It would have to change one's life. If you really do start to believe that idea that you can fundamentally change your emotional state, your experience of the world, well, your world's going to change. And that's what happened to me. And what a gift. It was freedom, really, the path of freedom. It's been said that the great taste of the Buddha's teachings of freedom, and that became my experience. So this gift of not being trapped in one's mental states, but being free to work with them was in essence what I was given and why I'm still doing what I do. I've kind of cultivated, refined perhaps that thinking, but essentially that was it. So that was the great gift of Buddha, changed my life. I have to say, and I used to say, I was always on the way out of the London West Centre. I'd say, well, I'm going back to America, I've got things to do. And in my head I was saying, well, maybe next week, maybe I'll give it a month, maybe to the end of the year. And I was always postponing this return to America, which was America was the promised land for me at that time. So I suppose I could say that, in a sense, the promised land started to come back home. My land is Britain, England, London. And that gradually, it took a long while, I would say, but gradually I began to see, well, the promised land is the land you create for yourself, not the one that's out there made in Hollywood or Warner Brothers Records or whatever. You know, it ultimately, again, it's within our domain to create our own promised land. But that was many years of practice to see that. But certainly in the first year or so, the view was I was always on the way out. And I think that was partly my escape exit, you know. I was getting a bit too serious in a way. And the idea that I would become involved in a religious, spiritual movement, church, essentially, as I saw it then, was not my view of myself. I didn't do religion. I'd done it. But I didn't do it anymore. So it was quite a conflict for a while. And I was involved in the avant-garde music world. And a lot of people in that world didn't do religion either. So it was a bit of a... There was a constant sort of tension there for quite a few years. Okay. So this talk is part of a series on Sangha. And Sangha means spiritual community. And if I'm honest, the thing that really kept me in this Buddhist centre, London Buddhist Centre, kept going back, was Sangha, was spiritual community. But to bring it down to earth, friendships, I just started to meet the most wonderful people from Dunray. And one of these people who was going to come tonight, but he didn't in the end, is my very dear friend and colleague Ananda. Some of us know Ananda. He's actually the senior most member of the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. He's been ordained, I don't know, it's 19 years more than me, so it's 42 years, I think. It's one of life's sobering things. I'll never catch him up in that way. So Ananda at this time was around the London Buddhist Centre himself. And I remember meeting Ananda. I don't actually remember when I met Ananda, but I remember that at some point in that first year, for sure, I did meet Ananda. And I think he probably hunted me out because he heard that it was a very small community at this time. I mean, I probably knew most of the order members in the world, actually. There were a few I wouldn't have seen. But if I think about it now, I don't know how many there were by then. 81? Less than 100?
Less than 100.
I met most of them. I bet I knew more, three quarters of the order by that time. Just by being at that centre, people would come and kind of go on the trees and so on. So it was a small community that I joined, as it were. In retrospect, it seemed. At the time, it didn't, and people had already seen how it had grown over the last few years. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that Ananda had been told there was this chap there who had been involved in music, and he was very interested in that as a writer, poet himself. So he very quickly made connections with me. And what I remember particularly about Ananda, he was very supportive. Anyone who knows Ananda will know this. In a very quiet, unassuming way, he was just very much giving me his blessing, as it were. So this touches on trying to not keep this too in-house, but what I discovered, and it was chance, because I'd had no contact with Buddhism isn't quite true, because name-dropping. I'd worked with a composer called John Cage, who was a Zen Buddhist and been a Zen Buddhist for many years. He was one of the first people in America post-war to really take on the Buddhist life, the Buddhist practices. I'd been lucky enough to meet Cage and work with him. So I'd had this connection through people like him, through the arts, with Buddhism. But what I discovered was that the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, as it was, in some ways was unique. One would have to qualify that. But in some ways was unique in that it was a path of awareness, for sure. But it was also a path of beauty, just put it that way. And that the founder of the Western Buddhist Order, he's not here tonight. No picture. Anyway, Sangharakshita, who founded orders. He too was a poet. He was very much a scholar and he was very much a meditator, but he was also a poet and had been writing poetry for most of his adult life, if not earlier. And it was a very important part of his life. It wasn't the most public part of his life, but it was certainly a crucial part of his life, and he's talked about it. So he was always very encouraging of people who did have an artistic practice to keep going. And this was true of Ananda. It was Sangharakshita, I think, who really encouraged Ananda to take his writing seriously. So to be both a Buddhist practitioner and a practicing artist. And that's not always been the case in all schools of Buddhism, because some views are that, well, if you get too involved in beauty and art, you're just going to get very distracted. And the real practice is just to be mindful. Well, if that was Buddhism, I wouldn't have stuck around. That was very clear. But as Ananda puts it, I'm a poet first and a Buddhist second. I don't make that distinction anymore. But you know, my heart was in my art, and I couldn't just stop doing that. I tried actually for a while, but it wasn't going to work for me. But I was lucky enough to discover a sangha, a spiritual community, where the arts were not only valued but actually encouraged and seemed to be part of the religious spiritual life. And again, what a great blessing for me. I'm sure if I'd have gone to another Buddhist group, fine people, though, I'm sure they would have been, it probably wouldn't have worked for me. It was just pure chance that I happened to go to this particular place along the Buddha Center, this particular movement, Friends of Western Buddhism, and was given both meditation and the sense that one could also practice art, but not art to confirm who you are. As I put in writing, no, I think I actually cut it from writing away, I put it in the poet's way. Art not to confirm who you are, but to confirm your capacity for change. I thought a lot about this, and that was a little sentence I came up with, that art of spiritual practice is not to confirm who you are, but to confirm your capacity for change. It's a bit dense that, but that is essentially what Ananda and I teach at Wolfert Door, what I try and capture in my own writing, always that sense that we're not, and it comes back to this thing, we're not fixed, we're not written in stone. We don't have to be in a bad mood for all of our life. We can keep working. Little by little, we can make progress, we can change. That is the essence, it seems to me, of the Buddhist life. And it's the thing I try and cultivate through my writing. So, of course, my ego is involved, and I love it when people publish me and send me checks for my poetry or invite me on TV. That hasn't happened yet, but you never know. Yes, of course, part of me is pleased, proud, acknowledged, vindicated, all those things. I'm human. But that isn't why I do it. Not entirely, not probably even halfly why I do it. I do it because I see it as a practice of transformation. That's the important thing. W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, said, "Poetry is an argument we have with ourselves." I can subscribe to that. And in that argument comes the change, the transformation. What do I really value? What do I really stand by? What are my fundamental values? My fundamental values are that everyone has the capacity for transformation, that everyone has the capacity for loving kindness to themselves and to the world. And as Sangha Rakshita put it very beautifully in a talk he gave in Mumbai now, many years ago, that every human being is capable of being a friend to another human being. I love that. And I'm saying that because this touches on another important strand of my spiritual life, these 28 years and a few months now that I've spent in this Buddhist community. Shravana Marlini touched on it. It's just the work of the Karanar Trust. And I've talked here on various occasions about Karanars. Very briefly, it works in India, in particularly in the urban slums of India, with a population that are now known as Dalits, D-A-L-I-T-S, which means dirt, actually, in Hindi, Dalit. And these are people that were originally known as untouchables, and then ex-untouchables, and now, for very good reasons, probably you can see why they choose not to be thought of as ex-untouchables, but Dalits. And the connection is these people, millions of them now, have converted into Buddhism. Since 1956, there was a great man called Dr. Ambedkar, whose pictures are there on the bookshelf. Great leader of these people. In 1956, towards very near the end of his own life, he converted into Buddhism, and he did this to get out of the Hindu caste system and this notion that some people could be born as untouchable, that are so inferior that even sight of them in some cases would pollute higher caste. Sangha Rakshita got very involved with teaching this new Buddhist community the basic teachings of Buddhism, the Dharma, and helping them set up Sangha community. In the years after Dr. Ambedkar died, he died in December 1956, and this was one of the things that I inherited, as it were, when I got involved with this Buddhist community, because in 1980, a charity was set up by members of the order called Aid for India, AFI. And by 1985, I found myself working for AFI, as it was, on a fundraising appeal. And again, just very compacted, but fundraising appeals are where people come together. In those days, for 8 weeks, it tends to be 6 weeks now. They form a community, a sangha, a spiritual community, and they go out night after night, knocking doors, and trying to raise money. Some of us have done this. It's tough, it can be hell, but it can be fantastic. And in 1985, feeling I needed to pay back some of the good fortune I had in my life, I decided to do one of these appeals. And this was probably the first thing that changed my life. I suppose you can keep changing life, can't you? Should, you know? Car accident, London Buddhist Center, fundraising. Yeah, for sure. And over the years, that practice developed for me, became more and more significant. So that by 1987 I was actually running these things, these appeals for this charity. I was one of the people who helped change its name from Afindu, which was increasingly an anachronism, felt all wrong, to Karanar, which is a beautiful Indian word which means compassionate action based on wisdom. That's one way you could try and say Karanar. It's one of the qualities we try and develop for many. Meditation, like metta, karuna, love and kindness. So we became karuna, and I was fundraising money. And apart from an interlude when I worked for Friends of the Earth, when I first moved to from Oxford to Bristol in 1990, I've actually been working for karuna ever since. These days I'm a sort of visiting trainer. I'll be doing it next week. In fact, I'll be doing it on Thursday because we have a fundraiser in Bristol. So I still do this one. And it's very important to me. And I've said that I hope it's the last thing I stop doing. I am going deaf, that's another story. But I'll keep doing this for as long as I can because it's so important to me. I love it. I love the practice that it gives us, but I also love the people in India that I've been privileged enough to get to know. They're very special to me, and they've come from hell, these people. No, that's not a metaphor, that's the truth. These people have come from hell, hell on earth, to be treated as less than a cow, which is what the Hindu caste system posits. It's not a good place to be. And my view is it's not a world I want to live in. And if I can do anything to change that, then I must. That's what I do. So that's one of the things that Buddhism has given me. Actually, yeah, put it this way. Buddhism has given me a capacity to see how I can make the world a better place. That's very grandiose, but I think it's true. I've seen the effects of the work that I do and that I help others do. I can see the effects of this. I've seen children in little kindergartens in slums in India who are learning to read and write because of the work that we've been doing, because the streets that we knock on cold winter nights trying to get people to give money. This has an effect. So it's a great, great gift to me. So that's another thing. So that's a very interesting thing. I would never have considered that Buddhism would have done that. Because the truth is that before I had that car accident, I was quite self-obsessed, if I'm honest. I still am, actually. My primary experience is my own. I thought that's true for everyone, but I'm very tuned into myself. Even as a child, my own experiences were very important to me, and trying to understand them, make sense of them, was really what I was about, and writing music, and then songs, and then poetry, and so on. Has all been part of that process, but and that was a very precious thing, and I absolutely rejoiced it was a gift that I was given, as it were. But it was a bit self-centered. It was a bit myopic, and fundraising karuna sort of opened me out to the world. Put this another way, I think I used art to protect myself from the world. My very last composition teacher was a very brilliant Australian composer called David Lonsdale up at Durham University. And strangely enough, another connection is that he, during the time I was working, studying with him, was becoming a Zen Buddhist, like John Cage. So two of my most important teachers, Cage and David Lonsdale, were both, well, one had, but were on this path of Buddhism, and that was a strange thing. That was in the 2 years before I had this car accident. So there was definitely a sense I was moving in a particular direction. But anyway, I remember David said to me, a very wise, beautiful thing, he said, "You're writing music to protect yourself from life, but really I think you want to write music that celebrates life." That was such a... I was actually quite angry with him. I actually swore at him. I said, "You have no... You're here to teach me how to write music. You're not here to teach me how to live my life." But of course, what a stupid thing to say. You can't separate life like that. And he said it with a lot of sincerity, warmth and kindness, concern. And I later thanked him because that was a key moment for me. He opened the idea that life wasn't just about writing music and that life could be celebrated through art. And so that became part of my Buddhist practice, which is one reason why I teach writing, to help people see them. Okay, now I'm coming to the end, but I can only, at this point, throw the spotlight on this man sitting here, Manju Vajra. So I hope I don't embarrass you, but because this man, and I did ask him today, I sent him a text and said, "I'm giving this talk, if you are, would you like to come?" And he, fantastic, beautiful, he's a great guy. He came, and it's fantastic to me, because Manju Vajra, again, is one of the key people in my life. How so? Well, I was thinking about this recently. In December 1993, I was on my way from New York, was having a very, very turbulent love affair with a flute player, a very beautiful flute player. And to get some kind of sanity, which is a nice way of saying she kicked me out the door, I got on a train and I was on my way to New Hampshire to see actually this person who said to me, Donna, a concert pianist friend, who'd said to me, "You should learn to meditate after my car accident." So I was actually going to see her for Christmas, sort of, yeah. And on my way to New Hampshire, I passed through Boston, and some people at the London Buddhist Centre had given me some books and I think posters and things to deliver to Manju Vajra, who was living in Boston, and he and a man called Vajradhaka, who was actually also here this weekend visiting, and a man called Punya, who died about 18 months ago, lovely man Punya. They'd gone to Boston to set up one of these centres, right? So I was kind of acting as courier for these books and posters, and I still remember it. Manju Vajra was waiting for me as I got off the train from New York, and we'd never met. But I knew it was Manju Vajra as soon as I saw him. How did I know? Because he had this sort of presence, he had this quality that I'd begun to notice that members of this order had. And I think it was just presence, and it was presence because he was present. This is how I'd begun to understand it. Through practice, you do try and just be where you are. And I could see that this was someone, he stood out in this crowded South Station bus. There was this chap. Anyway, we went up and we had a coffee and he saw me off on the bus. And I don't remember details now, but he certainly said, "Why don't you come back to Boston?" An idea, a seed was planted, and a few months later, I did indeed come back, and I lived with Manju Vajra and Vajradhaka in the Boston Buddhist Center. I've sometimes said it's the only center ever, and I've been around the world teaching, where there were evenings where no one came to a class. And my take on this, maybe I can't speak for Manju Vajra, I might be able to speak for Vajradhaka, was there was a point, like 3 or 4 minutes before the class began, where you're almost thinking, well, because, see, we were living above an ice cream shop, J.P. Licks, which are probably the best ice cream.
Best in the United
States. And really pretty girls serving, I have to say. So, So, and there was only one evening where it didn't happen. But, and of course, there was that moment when someone turned up. But you know, bless them. And bless these guys, because they were always there, and they consistently were teaching these practices that we're doing here. So anyway, I was there with Manjubhadra and Vajradhara. I came back to London, moved into the community in London Buddhist Center. This would have been September 1984. And a year later, I again remember this very good, less than a year later, I got a phone call from Manjubhadra on the end of a phone. He was in America. And he was asking me if I would consider coming back to America to join a community which he was creating up in New Hampshire, a place called Arialoka, two geodesic domes, which were joined, wooden, beautiful structure in the woods of New Hampshire that he had found, and God knows how, because you had no money, did you? But somehow, legally, I have to say,
mercy.
Had managed to purchase these on a mortgage, and he was looking for people, I was going to say idiots like me, but that was not quite fair, but to come and join, which it took me, funny enough, I think I was one of the first people you asked, so I was the last person to get it, which is symptomatic, because it did take me a lot of hard thinking. And I remember Sangharak Shitta, the founder, did say to me, just go, it'll be all right. I was worried about getting ordained, you see. I wanted to get ordained. He said, just go, it will be all right. And he was right. So I lived with Manjubhadra. And God, I must have been a pain. I mean, they used to say to me in the London Buddhist Centre, well, let's put it this way. Another friend of mine, Nagabodhi, said to me, he sometimes felt you could tell if someone was ready for ordination if you could ask them to post a letter and they did it. Of course, he was being ironic. But the truth was, he couldn't have relied on me to post a letter because I'd go off somewhere. Oh, that's nice. I'd start thinking. You know, so I've been getting better because obviously I've been practicing for a few years. But I feel when I arrived on Manchester, Fadra's geodesic doorstep, I was still, you know, partially there, but partially not. And that was a very important year for me. It was a difficult year, it was a painful year, but it really, it really moved me something deeply. And I've revered Manjubhadra because he was so kind and so patient, generous, not just to me, to all of us, but he had this huge project and it was really tough. It was hell sometimes. I mean, I remember, and I'm sharing, I'll turn the machine on. There was one weekend we had a community meeting on Saturday, and Manjubhadra said there was 7 of us for seeing it, mostly Brits. And he said, well, guys, if we don't get any work in the next week, we're just going to have to give up. And I don't think I was alone in sort of thinking, and in fact, I don't know if you know this, but later on we actually worked out what we would do with the money. We were all going to go down to Florida, actually. Did you know that? Ratnapani hatched a scheme that we had a few old beat-up vehicles and we were just going to drive down Florida to the sun. I don't know what we were going to do, but we were just going to get a hell away from New Hampshire, the cold, and these bloody geodesic domes that were like. But we didn't. The money that week, miraculously, as often, the money, we got work, the money came in. And Arialoka's still there. And indeed. Pardon?
The 25th anniversary, wow. A few weeks ago.
Fantastic. I was last there in 2006. I was doing a little tour to launch, promote Writing Away, and I taught a workshop there and stayed there for a week. And it was beautiful to be back there and see how much it's taken root, has become part of the local community, the local society, which I have to say was the struggle we had, wasn't it? We were very much like, we were regarded with a lot of suspicion, you know, the local people, these strange Buddhists who were not only that, but not American Brits. It was a long struggle, and I know Manjubhadra, he stayed much, he saw it through, and I left after him. But anyway, so thank you, Manjubhadra. And I think I'm partly named after Manjubhadra, I think Sangharak Shitta decided to do that, to kind of acknowledge that connection. So my name is Manju Svara, and Manju means gentle. Vajra is lightning, thunderbolt. It's well named. Svara means music, gentle music. And indeed, I did get ordained, actually only just about a year after I left Ariloka. And I think that Sangha Akshita was right. Just go, it will be all right. I think if I'd have stayed in London, I might not have got ordained quite so easily, because that was a testing ground. I mean, in Buddhism, there's this idea of the cremation ground, where you go to face your demons and really confront your fears. And Ariloka was definitely that for me. It was, I would say, the beginning of adulthood, actually, even though I was 27. It was the beginning of seeing I had to take responsibility for myself. Okay, let me just we'll run on for a second, but let me end with another poem. I was trying to think of a way to end. I'll end with this little poem. It's a haiku, if you know what haikus are. 17 syllables, 3 lines. Not a classic haiku, but it's least in structure. Haikus tend to be about seasons and impermanence. Maybe this is about that. It's called Shakyamuni. Shakyamuni is a name given to the Buddha, who, by the way, was a human being, if you didn't notice. The Buddha wasn't born a demigod, he wasn't an angel. He was a human being who, through practice, awakened. Buddha means to awaken. And one of the names given to him is Shakyamuni. Shakyamuni. Something called to him. Something called to him, repeated over and over, and he noticed. Shakyamuni. Something called to him, repeated over and over, and he noticed. That's a very condensed little poem, but what that meant to me was, I loved that idea that the Buddha just noticed. I mean, this is said in the scripture. He just paid attention. He sat under a tree in northern India, a Bodhi tree, and he just paid attention. He sat there, and he sat there, and he sat there, and he kept noticing, as it were. And he kept noticing to such an extent that he broke through from our human experience to an enlightened experience, which is a human experience. In a way, I like to think of it, he became a human being. Actually, I think the truth is that we're not. We're sort of halfway there, but we go to sleep and we get distracted, we get fed up, we get bored. And so we keep moving off this awareness that is being given to us all the time. The other thing I love about Buddhism, its teaching, is you can practice it anywhere, anytime. In fact, you should. You don't have to be sitting in a room like this to practice Buddhism. You should be practicing it when you're peeling the potatoes. It's the Zen idea. You should always be present to yourself and to the world, wherever you are. That is the essence of Buddhism. It's noticing. The things to notice are being given to us all the time. And it wasn't until through an amazing series of coincidence, good fortune, it was only when I stepped through that door at the London Buddhist Centre, when I did get on that bus, when I did get off it, when I did go to London Buddhist Centre, that I was taught how to notice, that life's worth paying attention to. Actually, it's a very precious thing, life. It's worth noticing. So, here we are. Here I am. Halfway and beyond now in my life. And I always thought I was on the way out. I thought, I'll go a couple of weeks. Meet this guy, go, Durray! And then I go. I'm still leaving, actually. But it's a slow withdrawal, a long goodbye. Okay, thank you.